Codex Immortalis Esperantus is a Latin phrase I invented, which means the code of the aspirational immortal. You can think of it as a biohacker twist on a phrase and concept that I love, noblesse oblige, the obligation of nobility, the idea that privilege entails a great and weighty responsibility. Responsibility to edify not just yourself, but society. Responsibility to influence. Responsibility to be a rudder when those you love endure the storms of life. Responsibility to not just leave a legacy, but to be around to maintain its foundation. Dear listener, you may be falling short of this. And here's why. If you're into biohacking and anti-aging, you're an aspirational immortal. But I challenge that the scope of your ambition might not match the potency of your aspirations. Your aims should include goals measured not just in months, years, and decades, but also centuries. This is a call to action to start thinking a lot bigger. As a person who aspires to live as long as you want in brilliant health, you're probably underestimating what you might accomplish in your life. And today I'm joined by a man that this should resonate with. I'm joined by Dr. Jeffrey Gladden, a board-certified cardiologist and longevity pioneer who has dedicated his career to cracking the code of age reversal, moving beyond mere healthcare into the realm of human performance. He's the author of a new book, 100 is the New 30. And later in this interview, I'm going to press him a little on this title. Some, is it mere puffery, which is to say a marketing claim that no reasonable person would take seriously? Also, he operates Gladden Longevity, which is a boutique anti-aging clinic that is very much on the cutting edge of applied biohacking. I'm Jonathan with Limitless. Dr. Gladden, welcome.
Hey, Jonathan. Thank you. It's good to be here.
First question. I'm going to give you a hypothetical. So there's a shadowy investment group that offers to invest billions into Gladden Longevity, all the money in the world, to where cost money would never be an impediment to progress in your mission. And so you entertain the offer, and this shadowy investment group, they say, hey, come and meet us at like an opulent villa or a yacht. And so you go there, they have a limo pick you up at the airport, and you go and meet them. And these investors are a surprisingly youthful looking group. And then they reveal something unexpected. They aren't just investors. They are immortal vampires. And these vampires, they believe that your work, especially around telomeres, could expose their vampire biomarkers, which they don't want because they've been living alongside humanity in the shadows since time immemorial. And that's the status quo masquerade, as they call it, that they want to maintain. So they make you an offer. Take the money and suppress longevity research that could lead to the public revelation of their existence. And instead of like democratizing longevity tools, increase your prices dramatically. They don't want you selling longevity to the public on your website. They want you to sell it exclusively to multimillionaires and billionaires in the orbit of their influence. And these vampires, they offer you a fang to the neck. They can make you a vampire, and you could live for centuries or millennia like them. And if you refuse, they won't harm you physically, but they tell you, look, we are very skilled at running sophisticated propaganda operations. And with our propaganda operations, we could destroy your reputation and we could discredit the entire field of longevity research that you've contributed to. But they don't just make threats. They also make the argument that mass longevity would destabilize society because of overpopulation, resource strain, the undermining of cultural cohesion that comes from belief systems contingent on the consensus of the inevitability of death. And they reveal that for the past centuries, they have been shepherding humanity out of the darker impulses of our evolutionary psychology. And they argue that in just a few centuries, humanity will be ready to live lives stretching into the three-figure range, but not now. And that's why they want to pay you billions. And they say to you, longevity is for the few, not the many, as they raise a crystal champagne flute of blood to their lips. So the question with that rather cinematic scene that I painted, the question is, would you accept the vampire's deal? What does the Codex Immortalis Esperantis require in that situation? Would it be loyalty to the truth and humanity or strategic compromise to preserve progress on your work?
Yeah, well, interesting construct. It covers a number of different things. I think the way that I think about it is that, we frame up longevity. The book is 100 is a new 30, right? So the idea is when we're 100 years old or beyond, that we have a very youthful body. That's the concept. But the other concept that's written about extensively in the book is actually developing a 300/3,000/3 million-year-old mind, right? And the reason I talk about that is because I think longevity represents the greatest opportunity humanity has ever had to really level up what it is to be human. So I love your admonition for people to think beyond just themselves as they're going down the longevity journey. How do they actually, from a noble place, how do they actually help others accomplish similar goals? And so being a human and not a vampire, my mission here is actually to democratize longevity. And the thing about that is it's not just about helping people live longer so they can, play more tennis or golf or whatever. It's really about elevating the mind and the spirit in a way that people have much more equanimity, they have much more perspective, much more wisdom, much more love and caring for each other. And they move beyond some of the binary thought processes that seem to lead to lots of conflict around the globe, whether it's in a family, in a marriage, between countries. So there's, for me, the real passion that I have is money is just a resource, right? There's plenty of resources in the world. So being offered, a big pool of a resource is not particularly attractive, right? What's much more interesting is to actually create a movement around transforming the planet so that every living creature on the planet benefits from human longevity. Because people become more wise, more caretaking, more loving, there's less conflict, and we're more responsible towards the planet and each other. To me, that goal and that aspiration dwarfs anything related to either my own, quote unquote, immortality as a vampire or a pool of resources, which quite honestly, we all have access to all the resources we need anyway. So I don't find it very appealing. The discrediting element, you know, is interesting. So you've kind of painted the scenario with a carrot and a stick, so to speak. But you know, there are always going to be naysayers, and so you know, I wouldn't be dissuaded by that either. And I don't think I'm on a chaotic, you know, mission here either. That's not the point. I really do believe that we are going to be able to crack the code on aging, and that we will be able to democratize it to the extent that people want to participate in it. Obviously, it's a personal choice. But I think that we can actually crack the code leveraging lots of AI, probably some of the quantum AI things coming. Optimization of systems, you know, this is what quantum AI does exceptionally well. And so I don't think we're that far away from actually being able to crack the code. When you think about AI in general, I think with all the jobs that could be displaced by it, I think there's going to be a crisis of meaning. I think there could be a crisis of meaning for people because a lot of meaning comes from the work that people do. And I think if that's the case, then this idea of developing not only physical health, but also emotional, mental, and spiritual health becomes even more critical as we transition. Humanity is transitioning, right? The globe is transitioning. AI is transitioning us. And it's interesting, there's an interesting hypothesis that 2 years after people discover radio waves, or any cultures, any civilization on any planet discovers radio waves, they have 200 years before they self-destruct. And we're, you know, radio waves were discovered in 1895, so right about there. So, you know, you could think about, you know, what is the responsibility we have? How do we make wise decisions with regards to these new technologies that we're developing? How do we not end up blowing ourselves up? So this is why I think the 300/3,000-year-old mind is so critical too.
Talking about these Methuselah-like lifespans, a major crisis that people are going to hear more and more and more about as time goes on is the fertility crisis. We all over the world, we are soon, more and more of us are going to have the experience of living in something akin to a Japanese village where there just aren't enough babies and children to keep society going. So do you see longevity working on that problem as well? Do you see the kind of longevity tools that work on telomeres or boosting NAD? Are these the kinds of things that are going to enable societies to stay above that population replacement number?
Well, it's an interesting question, right? So if you have fewer babies, but older people are youthful and living a longer time, then you don't have the detriment in population, right? But at some point, you're going to need to, you know, all biology needs to replenish itself. And so you are going to need to have children coming into play. There was an interesting postulate that was made in a hypothetical conversation with an AI about how would AI destroy humanity? And so, well, one of two ways. We either basically put out so much disinformation that we get everybody angry at each other and they start, you know, blowing everybody up with nukes, right? So that's one way. The other way is we basically create a virtual reality where everyone is so addicted to the dopamine hits that they stop reproducing, right? And so you can almost sort of see some of that playing out right now. Not that I think there's probably AI in the news for sure. And then there is really the youth today are, you know, birth rates are down, marriages are down, dating is down, everything is down, right? And that is not a good sign for humanity's longevity, right? As a species. So it's a really interesting, we find ourselves at this really, 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 really interesting place in human history where we're at a critical moment is how I see it. And this is why I think the developing the psycho-spiritual space to have the wisdom and the insight, the love and compassion, and the courage, quite honestly, to procreate, to raise children, to go forward, and to stay youthful at the same time, to reclaim the planet. I think it's a really interesting time. We don't really realize just how interesting it is. I think if you were to look back at this from 50 years in the future, you would say, oh my gosh, these guys were sitting at a pivotal moment in human history. And what decisions did they make? And how did they actually construct what it is they're trying to accomplish? You can't accomplish something that you can't, you know, conceive of, just like you can't get an answer to a question you're not asking. And so it's very important that we frame the questions that will move us forward, right? So this is why I think, how do we develop, the questions we have at Glad Longevity are, how good can we be? How do we make 100 the new 30? How do we live well beyond 120? Crack the Hayflick limit. How do we live young for a lifetime with youthful curiosity and invigoration? And how do we develop a 300/3,000-year-old mind to where we have the wisdom to actually, you know, shepherd the species forward in a way that's survivable? So, yeah, pretty interesting.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to circle back around to the psycho-spiritual development piece. Mm-hmm. There was a section of your book where you wrote something kind of mind-blowing on that. But, okay, so about your book, 100 is the new 30. I also wrote a biohacking book with a pretty clickbaity title. So I'm trying to not throw too large of stones in a glass house here. But is 100 is a new 30? This is a pretty fantastic claim. Is this puffery? Is this optimism? Or do you have patients who are like pushing towards 100 years old who have biomarkers of a 30-year-old?
The answer is no. We don't have people like that in the practice. We don't have anyone that age in the practice. It gets back to the idea that, and you mentioned this in your soliloquy when you started the podcast, that, you know, society has really normalized aging, right? And we've accepted it. It permeates everything. We're told when we're, at this age, we can now do this. And then when we're at that age, well, you shouldn't be doing this. And now it's time to retire. And now it's time to slow down. And you shouldn't go skiing anymore. And now it's, you know, it's this, 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 and this. And there's all these social cues and governmental cues. And even in our families and our other, you know, institutions, there's all these cues and clues about what you should and shouldn't be doing. And it's all normalizing aging. And so I reject all of that. I think that's, might have been true in the past, but I think we live in a day and age really where the technology is evolving so quickly that we are going to be able to live young for a lifetime. We are going to basically have a 30-year-old body when we're 100. And we can't do it today, but I can tell you we'll never get there unless we're asking a question, how do we actually do that? One of the things for the listeners here that I found incredibly helpful is that I was born in 1954, February of 1954, so I just had a birthday. And what I found incredibly helpful is that, you know, I've made some laps around the sun, but I wake up 27 every day. And the reason I wake up 27 is I'll be 27 this decade, 28 the next decade, 29 the next decade. When I'm 100, I'll be 30. So waking up 27 is one of the most powerful things that I can possibly do, and I'll tell you why. Because if I get up and I don't feel 27, then I never say to myself, oh, but look, you're great for your age. You just did a snowboarding trip. You're going to go mountain biking this weekend. You can do anything you want in life, right? You're as smart and as bright as you've ever been, if not more. I never say that. I say, what do I need to do to get back to 27? What do I need to do to get back to 27? And because I'm driven by that question, it enables me to find the solutions. And that's the key. The key is to actually keep your eye on the prize. If people told me, well, you know, you shouldn't go snowboarding, you know, you did this, you did that, I would say, no, I'm 27, I'm going to go, right? And so can you see the power of that? I think that it's not just a mind trick. Like, I've had accidents and some injuries and things like that where I thought, you know what, I'm going to have to give up on this idea of being 27. And every time that I got to that point, I doubled down on it. And I actually, you know, figured out how to rebuild my knee, how to, you know, solve this problem, how to do that problem. And it's that mindset that drives everything forward. So this is something that you can implement at home for free, right? You can just pick an age that you want to be for the rest of your life, and then wake up that age every single day.
At 27, I was like chasing girls in nightclubs three nights out of the week. So that might not be a good age.
No, it's not. You're missing the point. The point is not what you were doing at 27. The idea is to have the body that you had and the physical health that you had at 27. And then along with that, you're developing the wisdom of the 300-year-old mind so that you're not necessarily, you know, doing things that you look back on now and say, well, maybe that wasn't the best choice, right?
Aha, okay. All right, so we've delved into the philosophical and we may dip back into it, but let's get practical. So I wanted to ask you, which longevity tool do you think best doubles as an instant satisfaction biohack, or something close to instant satisfaction biohack for brain power and for motivation? My wheelhouse of content has kind of been in evaluating and reviewing a bunch of different nootropics and different tools for boosting brain power so that I can be a better entrepreneur now, so that I can be a better father. But yeah, I know that some of the longevity tools are, yeah, that they might not be real instant satisfaction, but I'm wondering in your experience, which one gives people the most immediate feedback as far as ROI in their focus and motivation and capacity to get stuff done in life?
Better sex.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm being a little bit facetious, but not. I think here's the point. The point that almost everybody misses when it comes to longevity, and I see this over and over and over again in quote-unquote longevity clinics, is that it's all about the solutions. Like, okay, we're going to take these nootropics, we're going to use cerebral lysine, we're going to use C-Lank and C-Max, we're going to, you know, do transcranial magnetic stimulation on the brain to do all these things that augment the brain, all of which we do here, right? The point, though, however, is really not what can you do. The point is, who am I? What do I actually need? That's the question that needs to be asked first. And so what we find is that what's really important and the way we get amazing results for our clients is not by saying, come in and we'll do this for you. It's come in and let us deconstruct you. Let us actually fully deconstruct you as well as we can to understand, what are your genetics? What are your predispositions? Do you have any history of anxiety, depression? Are you headed towards dementia, heart disease? Is cancer in your future? You know, once you actually understand the cards that you've been dealt genetically, then you can actually start to play the hand. And on top of that, you have to know where you are with regards to the mosaic of biological ages that you have. Maybe your brain is actually, you know, maybe you have the brain of an 18-year-old. Maybe the issue is your cardiovascular system, or maybe your bone density, or maybe something else, right? So the idea is to fully deconstruct yourself and do the testing that's required to understand that, so you know actually which levers to pull. Because it's very possible to get hung up on a therapy and say, oh, well, if I just boost NAD, I'll be great. Well, guess what? If you have cancer cells or predisposition, NAD may be exactly the wrong thing for you, right? So there are many things that, even peptides, there are certain peptides you don't want to use if you have some predisposition for cancer. So the idea is everybody's focused on what can they do, when in actual fact, the initial step, and just like claiming an age is critical, the initial step should be, who am I, right? And that means biologically, biochemically, anatomically, genetically, psychospiritually, cognitively, who am I? Where am I? And then from there, it's like, oh, okay, well, here's what I need to do. And that's how you actually get durable results that actually take you towards the 30-year-old body and the 300-year-old mind, and you don't get hit by a bus you didn't see coming. That's super important. Yeah.
Okay. You broached the subject. So give us some sex hacks.
Yeah. So, well, here's the thing about sexual function. Number one, we talked about the issue of people not dating and lack of procreation, right? So obviously having children is important. But here's the thing about sexual function. It's really a great canary in the coal mine for so many things. Sexual function depends on many things psychologically as well as physiologically. It's very difficult for people to engage in sexual activity if they don't feel safe, right? And one of the things that we've learned is that everybody, at least everyone I've met, has suffered some form of trauma, right? They've had some form of trauma in their life, a loss, losing a mother at a young age or being bullied or, you know, this, that, or the other thing, right? And so everybody has suffered trauma. And the thing is that the human psyche is such that we all end up living in reaction to that trauma. And so one of the real keys to developing the 300-year-old mind is actually to go in and understand that trauma. What actually happened? Who was I at that moment? Who were they? What went down? And then get to a point where you can actually forgive everyone involved, including yourself and the other person. And forgiveness for me was always kind of an abstract term, right? If you were to say to me, Jonathan, well, I forgive you. It's like, well, I don't know exactly what happened, or I forgive you, or what just happened, right? So for me, I've come to understand forgiveness is that right now, Jonathan, you and I have unconditional positive regard for each other, right? This is a, right? You're nodding your head, yes. And so that being the case, if something were to come up where trust was violated in some fashion, then we would raise a psychic barrier between, I would raise a psychic barrier, probably you would too, between you and me to say, well, I'm not going to allow unconditional positive regard to go to that person or come back from that person necessarily. The problem with that is that it takes psychic energy for us to hold that barrier up. And the more we hold that barrier up, the more isolated we become. And so forgiveness for me, once we deeply understand everything that happened, if we were to really deconstruct what happened between us in this hypothetical case, we would then lower the barrier and say, okay, I'm going to drop the barrier. There's not going to be no barrier to the flow of unconditional positive regard. And that's forgiveness. And if you do that, if you're listening to this and you think about someone with whom you have some sort of issue, and you just in your mind mentally drop that barrier for a minute and say, what does that feel like? It's almost like a sense of relief. It's like, oh, okay, I don't have to hold that barrier up anymore. And if there's unconditional positive regard coming from them towards me, that's fine. It doesn't mean I'm going to call them up and go to lunch. But it all of a sudden, it lowers the drain on our psyche, right? So this is super important when it comes to, the whole idea of forgiveness. And I think that out of that, when you start to get your psyche aligned, then you can actually make progress on some of the other things that we're talking about. So,
okay. So unconditional positive regard, lowering barriers. This connects to a section in your book that I highlighted.
So let me come back to sex. Yeah, because here's the deal. If we don't feel safe, then it's difficult to engage in sexual activity. So working on healing traumas, and once we heal the trauma, then we can get to a point where we actually transcend the trauma. We become grateful for everything that happened because it made us more wise, more empathetic, and more understanding, right? Now we become unencumbered from the trauma, right? And that is liberating. When we're liberated, we have much more ability to interact with other people from a place of equilibrium rather than being on tilt, living in reaction to traumas that have happened to us. The other thing is that realizing that there's nothing external to us that can ever make us feel safe. You know, the $1 billion or multi-billion dollar question from the vampires. Well, why would somebody take that? Well, you know, lots of different reasons. But in actual fact, nothing external to us can make us feel safe. Billions of dollars can't make us feel safe, right? No relationship, no country we live in. All of it can be taken away, all of it. And history shows us that over and over again. All of it can be taken away in a matter of seconds. So if we're going to have safety, and in order to function sexually well and ethically, we need to feel safe. So giving ourselves safety becomes critical, right? And that's a psycho-spiritual question. How do we feel connected to something greater than ourselves? How do we actually feel safe no matter what life circumstances show up? The other thing is love itself, unconditional love for ourselves. I never felt unconditional love. I know you have a baby in the next room. I actually never felt unconditional love until my son was born. And that was the first time I felt unconditional love for another human being. It's like, oh my gosh, what is this love? It's unbelievable, right? And maybe you felt that too. Yeah, you're nodding your head, right? And it's like, oh, well, I never got that as a kid. In fact, I never really gave that to myself. So I took mom out of her psychic spot and dad out of his psychic spot, put unconditional love there. Then, you know, I love little Jeff as well. So now I've got a three-legged stool of unconditional love. So now I'm loved. I feel safe. I'm not living in reaction to traumas. Now, psychically, I can really engage with someone and be very intimate. I can be vulnerable. I can get to know them. They can get to know me. And in developing a relationship, you know, the idea for me of a relationship, what's a great relationship? Well, for me, it's to know and be known and to love and be loved. And that actually came to me in a deep meditation that I did one night when I got up in the middle of the night. I couldn't sleep for a minute, got up, was reading some Eckhart Tolle, The Power of Now, and I went into a deep meditative trance. I just, you know, just dropped into it. And there was this river of love flowing through everything. And on the other side of the river was an entity. You could call it God or source or spirit or whatever. And I was telepathically communicating with this entity, and there was a complete knowing and being known and loving and being loved. And I said, oh my gosh. When I came out of the trance, it's like, oh my gosh, that's it. That heaven is not pearly gates. Heaven is that. And a great relationship is that as well. So in my own relationships, I work to know and be known and to love and be loved. And if we solve our traumas and we feel unconditional love for ourselves and we feel safe, then we can start to enter into the vulnerability and the intimacy and the courageous conversations it takes to really develop intimacy. And that's really missing. You know, we have so much digital stimulation, people aren't really developing intimacy. And a great deal of sexual satisfaction doesn't come from orgasm. It comes from the intimacy that we feel with someone else, because in that intimacy, oxytocin is released. And when oxytocin is released, guess what? It does everything you want for longevity, right? It lengthens telomeres. It decreases DNA damage. It lowers oxidative stress. It decreases inflammation. I mean, oxytocin is really, right? It's pretty awesome. Exactly. It makes your brain better for that matter, right? So, and then you can get creative. You can get creative with your partner or partners or whatever, you know, there's no, whatever works for you. But the point is, sexual activity is a wonderful metric of psycho-spiritual health. Then physiologically, of course, you've got to have good nerve function. You've also got to have good blood flow function. And so if you're having difficulties with erectile dysfunction, a lot of times that can be mediated by blood vessels that are not able to bring blood into the genitalia. Maintaining erection is another piece of that. And then the nerve conduction is another piece of that. So all those things can be deconstructed and addressed. But if you're able to have great intimate relationships and great sexual activity, it's really a great metric of your overall health. So
there's a damn good argument for monogamy in the fact that sex is, it imbues life with so much, and you can have great sex for a whole century if you're serious about your health, you could have a whole century potentially of great sex
That's
ahead
right.
of you.
But better than ever sex, quite honestly. It just keeps getting better and better and better. That's the truth.
But you're going to get really sick of dating after just a few decades. After just a few decades, dating dating is going to get really, really old. And dating is just getting more and more ridiculous thanks to the technological absurdistan that we're advancing into. So yeah, it's a pretty good argument for monogamy, that you, if you want to have a century of good sex ahead of you, then you should, yeah, then you should probably wrangle your internal psychology enough so that you can manage a monogamous relationship. And
I'll just interrupt for a quick sec. I think, you know, people may take different views on that. You know, some people feel like polyamory is a better way to go. Some people feel monogamy is a way to go. And so I think here's what one of the things that I learned is that it doesn't really matter so much which path you choose. It's that you actually commit deeply to the work it takes to work on yourself, and the other person or persons are working on themselves, and you're working on the relationship. When that chemistry is there, it's like we're in the kitchen together and we're going to make the best meal ever, you know, and you're deconstructing and reconstructing the relationship to do that. That's how it actually thrives. So,
okay, maybe the vampires will expose you for your polyamorous liaisons. Maybe that's the angle that they can get you on.
I didn't say I was polyamorous. What I did say is that,
I didn't say I wasn't either.
Okay, leaving a little bit of mystery. Okay, so you, in your book, you describe this mindset tool for, it sounds like, shadow work. And I'm actually wondering if you can get a little bit more in detail about this. In the book, you wrote, "Through visualization exercises, I manifested a maternal energy seat and a paternal energy seat in my psyche. I went back and removed my mother's energy and replaced it with unconditional love that I felt for my son, and then directed it at little Jeff at age 3, and it felt totally good." Yet, is that as simple as it? Because there is a lot of people that have that. They kind of live in that Jungian shadow of mom and dad. And so is this as simple as the way it sounds in your book?
Well, it's not simple in the sense that the psyche has to be ready to make that leap. And so there's work that has to be done to understand the traumas and those kinds of things. But at the end of the day, when you're making progress, in my own life, when I've made progress in the psycho-spiritual space, it hasn't been gradual progress. It's been kind of like, you know, when you have an electron that orbits an atom, right? It's at one energy level when it's in one orbit, and then it jumps to another energy level in another orbit. It's a quantum jump, right? It doesn't gradually move from this electron volt energy to that. There's no gradation. It just jumps from one to the other. And so when I've had insights in the psycho-spiritual space, it's been that way. It's like all of a sudden it hits. It's like, oh, well, that's it right there. And you're able to make those quantum leaps. But in order to make the quantum leap, you have to put enough energy into the atom, into the system, to get it to have the enough energy to make that leap. And the same is true psycho-spiritually. You have to put enough energy and thought into, you know, resolving the traumas and unconditional love and feeling safe and some of the other things to get to a point where you can actually make that quantum leap. But once you make the quantum leap, you know, you can never unsee it. You can't go back, right? And so that's a very cool thing. So, yeah, that's how I would describe that. And then when it comes to shadow work, you know, Carl Jung was the one that really kind of popularized shadow work. And really what Jung was arguing for was that all of us have many, many parts. Parts that we would be proud to talk about in public from a stage, and parts that we might be ashamed to talk about on a stage. Maybe we do have greed. Maybe we do have lust. Maybe we are self-centered. Maybe we are, you know, violent on some level or whatever it is, right? And the point is that what he points out is that when you say, okay, there is that part of me that's back there in the shadow, if I don't bring that shadow piece forward and actually recognize them, then they're always going to be back there making trouble. And so what I've done in my own world is to create what I call a Knights of the Round Table, where I bring these three-year-old selves that may be selfish or whatever, and I say, oh, okay, come forward. You deserve a voice too. What is driving you to want to be selfish in this moment? And then loving that part of myself and giving them a seat at the table. And when you do that, now all of a sudden, you can become a whole person because all of you is welcomed, right? And you're not trying to suppress parts of yourself. It's a different way. And once you do that, things come into equilibrium. It's quite interesting. So anyway, that's kind of what the shadow work is about. Yeah.
Okay. There's a TV show I've been watching with my wife that actually does a pretty good job of portraying this. It's Mr. Robot. And it's this cyberpunk series about this like hacker guy that's has psychologically very dark. And he has these alternative personalities. And one of them is his father. One of them is his mother. One of them is him, I think at about 4 years old. And he confronts parents. He comforts the child version of himself and then like integrates over time. I think it's, I'm not a psychology expert, but this TV show, I think actually has a pretty.
That's it. That's what it is. Mm-hmm. No, you're hitting the nail on the head because what Jung talks about is it's once we integrate all the shadow pieces, then we can become a complete person. We don't have to shun parts of ourselves. A lot of us go around feeling ashamed of parts of ourselves, right? We have shame, guilt, remorse, things like that. And just like we need to deconstruct the traumas to understand what happened, we need to deconstruct those as well to understand why is that there? Where did it come from? You know, what was the voice that's saying that this is bad or wrong or whatever? And then actually, it doesn't mean that you become immoral. It just means that you welcome all the parts of yourself to the table. Everybody has a voice. And once everybody has a voice, then it's not working in the background, kind of disrupting your flow. You can accept that piece of yourself. It's a very beautiful thing to love yourself completely. Right. Not only is there unconditional love, but there's love for all of you. Right. All of you is welcome. When all of you is welcome, it's very, very soothing. And I'll tell you why this is so critical. In the book, I write about all this in the Life Energy Circle. I'm adding some things here that weren't written about in the book. But the point is, when you get the Life Energy Circle, the psycho-spiritual space dialed in, it really lowers the stress on the biology dramatically. I mean, really dramatically. And that's massive for longevity. It's not what can we do to turn back the clock. It's what do we do to slow down the clock in the first place and then turn it back, right? So that's how I think about it. Yeah.
Okay. In the book, you mentioned a couple times brain frequency TM. What is that?
Yeah. Brain frequency is a transcranial magnetic stimulation process that we do here at the clinic. It basically puts energy into the brain. We do EEGs to measure the amount of energy in different neurons throughout the brain, right? An EEG is like a cap that you put on that has electrodes scattered all over the brain to measure what's happening in different regions of the brain. And then based on what you find, you can actually program the machine to put energy back into those neurons. And it's kind of like doing a workout for the brain. It takes about 20 sessions. We do two a day for about 10 days for people. And sometimes it takes more. It's taken up to 40 sessions for people. But when you combine that with other things, and here's the other thing to keep in mind with longevity, it's so important when you have an intervention, once you have a diagnostic, to actually understand what it takes to actually rejuvenate and regenerate. And it's not just one thing. It's usually a whole system of things that actually gets it done. So for example, if you've got an older person that has more inflammatory cytokines in their system, doing plasmapheresis to actually take the blood out, throw away the old plasma, put back in saline albumin, and do that a couple times to sort of clean the system. And then if you actually teach them how to meditate, where they can calm their nervous system, go into a theta state and be in deep meditation, and then you do things that are regenerative, like brain frequency, stem cells, peptides, activated PRP, you know, things like that. They work a whole lot better when the psycho-spiritual space is actually calm and centered. There was an interesting paper showing that stem cells work a lot better when people have high parasympathetic nervous system tone, which is really the, you know, the vagus nerve bringing in acetylcholine to calm everything down, which correlates to a higher heart rate variability, or HRV, which most people listening are probably familiar with. So if you have a high HRV, you're going to be much better at healing, or these therapies are going to work better for you. This is why deconstructing this, which we do in the clinic, and measuring autonomic nervous system for individuals and then bringing it back into line is a big part of the longevity process. But you have to deconstruct it to know what's going on.
Switching gears, something I read in the book that I think I disagree some with, but maybe I don't know what I'm talking about. Okay, you wrote, the problem with cancer is that it's always diagnosed too late. How many times have you heard he or she was doing well, but then was then diagnosed at stage 3 or stage 4? It's because routine cancer screenings are inadequate to identify malignant cells early enough to take preemptive action. And like a lot of biohackers, I'm super skeptical of the mainstream approach to cancer, including the screening. I've read a couple of books about the cancer industry, and I'm pretty convinced of the, like, that cancer screening is part of the problem. Me and my wife never do any kind of cancer screening. And if I were ever to get cancer, I would forego the slash burn poison treatment. And I think I would just like take 6 months off of work and go lounge at the Black Sea nearby here and probably take a lot of C60 and chaga and fast a lot. But am I crazy?
Yeah. So, and I'll tell you why. You're not wrong in your skepticism of the sick care industry and the whole cancer industry. It is a big, in many respects, it's a big racket, right? I mean, the last thing the pharma companies want is for somebody to get a cure for cancer. That being said, I think that what's really important is if we're going to live for a long time and live well for a long time, is we need to know what is our risk for cancer. And that's where doing a genetic test to look at genetic predispositions for cancer, just because you have no cancer in your family doesn't mean you didn't get some predisposition. And just because you have cancer in your family doesn't mean that you got predisposition for cancer too. So really understanding the cards that you're holding, I think, is the very first thing. I would really highly recommend that to people, that that they think about it that way. Then the second thing is, routine cancer screening isn't really adequate, right? The tests are nonspecific and they don't always correlate to what's happening. You know, PSA is a great example of that. There is a cancer screening or a genetic screening from a company called Natera, N-A-T-E-R-A, Natera. It's the Empower Genetic Predisposition. It's 81 different SNPs. And the cool thing about that, I have no financial ties to these people, but the point is, if they do it and they find that you have a predisposition, they will test all of your blood relatives for free. And it's not a terribly expensive test. It's, you know, I'm going to say it's under $500, something like that. So, you know, that kind of insight is really important to have. Then the next thing is, there are better tests coming out to cause early detection of cancer. You know, everybody's heard about GRAIL. GRAIL is a terrible test. Galleri, GRAIL, awful test. Useless, quite honestly. It's only, its sensitivity for picking up stage 1 cancer is about 17%, which is quite useless, right? So there are better tests coming. There's a company out of India, actually, that's now doing testing in London as well. They're coming to the U.S. here in Denver, from what I understand. Again, I have no financial relationship to these people. It's a company called TZAR, T-Z-A-R, and they're going to have a test that will actually detect cancer at stage 1. They did a study showing that they had 85% sensitivity in their ability to do that. And then stage 2, of course, and on, they're almost 100% at detecting it and telling you what organ system it comes from. There are other companies out there that look at circulating tumor cells, which is not as sensitive, but when you find a circulating malignant cell and you do the DNA on that cell, you can see it's malignant, then it's pretty much, you can be confident you've got some cancer brewing. The beauty of it is that if you know your predisposition and you know what to look for and you're looking for it early and you find it early, then you can intervene early. And the problem is that when you intervene late, you know, you've got a really big uphill climb. So when it comes to cancer therapies, it's about, yes, making it difficult for the cancer cells to divide. That's part of it, right? And there are lots of therapies that will do that. But traditional therapies like chemotherapy, they make it hard for the cancer cells to divide, but they also damage your immune system. And the flip side of real cancer therapy is to make it hard for the cancer cells to divide and boost your immune system to go seek and destroy those malignant cells. And because malignant cells are very good at hiding themselves from the immune system, there's a series and a sequence of steps you go through to actually prime the immune system to learn how to go seek and destroy. And it's called training dendritic cells. And there are different companies that do that around the world and things like that. So anyway, the point being that cancer, you want to know about it sooner rather than later. You want to know if there's a predisposition. You don't want to put your head in the sand on this. And that's why I think we're going to come to a point where we can figure cancer out. The other thing that's real important is to know that we live in a polluted environment, right? So much air pollution, microplastics, all kinds of things. And many people do not detox very well. Detox is a three-step process of taking something that's potentially harmful and even not harmful and getting it out of your system completely. So you could take a molecule, let's say, that's somewhat cancerous, and it goes through stage one, and now it's even more cancerous than it was before. And if stage two, which will now make it where it's not cancerous at all, isn't working well, you can accumulate at stage one, right? And now you're actually, if your detox system isn't working properly, you're actually accumulating cancer through your own detox system. See what I mean? So understanding this and deconstructing your genetics around detox, the toxin loads that you're carrying, the status of your immune system, all these are things we deconstruct here in the clinic so people understand where they are, the cards are holding, where they are in the game, how to play the game. This is what's critical. It's not just about, well, we're going to do cold plunge sauna and take some nootropics. It's like, no, who are we really and where are we in this whole thing? That's how it goes.
One of the points your book makes is that aging is exponential and that it starts earlier than we think. So is there a rule of thumb on this that at a particular age, oh, I don't know, say 27 or 30, that people should really start to, are there certain anti-aging things that a 25-year-old doesn't need to worry about doing, that a 35-year-old does need to worry about doing, that a 45-year-old increasingly needs to worry about? Are there any rules of thumb that people can apply to their age?
Yeah, I mean, I think the question you're asking is a reasonable question. The correct answer is that it's different for different people, right? Different sexes, different people, different genetic makeups. I think the thing that's universally important for everyone, and I hope it gets done actually when kids are born, is that we do full genome sequencing on them and actually look at, you know, how are they built, right? And now how do we optimize them as they go through life and enable them to stay optimal and avoid the icebergs that are out there so they don't crash into them? So if you want to know, youth is technically sort of over. I mean, aging really starts in the womb, right? Telomeres are getting shorter, but youth is really considered to be over at about age 25. And so, you know, if you're going to give plasma, donate young plasma, you have to be under 25 in order to donate it, right? Or they won't take it. And that's because you start to accumulate more age-related inflammatory cytokines in the blood after that. So, you know, we thought that menopause for women started maybe late 40s, early 50s, something like that. We now know that it actually starts in the mid-30s, that there are hormonal changes that start even that early, right? And so egg populations in women decrease dramatically. At 18, if they were to donate eggs, they might get hundreds of eggs. If they donate them at 38, they might get 10, right? So there's a big decrease in reproductive health as well as hormonal health that occurs for everybody. That's pretty much a uniform. So actually understanding where your hormone levels are in your youthfulness becomes a benchmark that you can then say, okay, I was this at 18 or 21 or 22, whatever, and now I'm 38. How do I compare, right? And then you can kind of, for a man, you can kind of say, oh, well, this might be a better testosterone level for me. And it's more complicated than that because you've got to take into account cancer risks and prostate and other things. But the point is, if you set some good baselines early with genetics and testing a lot of the hormones and thyroid function, metabolites of hormones, how you're metabolizing them, I don't mean to overwhelm you. I mean, literally, it's hundreds of things that we measure, thousands of things we measure for clients to figure this out. But if you get some baselines around this, then you'll have a sense of, oh, I'm declining. Let me double check and see where are my hormones, where's my thyroid, that kind of thing. So,
one of the takeaways from the book that I got was that biological age is kind of BS. We see on the internet lots of health influencers like bragging about their biological age being a lot lower than their actual age. And yeah, it sounds cool. Like I'm 10 years younger than or 15 years younger than I should be. It sounds cool. But your book breaks down why this is kind of BS. Actually, I always suspected this was kind of BS because the companies that measure this probably do not want to insult their customers, who some of their customers are inevitably going to end up being quite a bit older than their chronological age. And I'm like, do these companies, I can see how it looks great to the companies if influencers are bragging about being 15 years younger, but there's also going to be a lot of people that are going to be older than chronological age. And then those people are going to be perhaps leaving one-star reviews for these companies. So I'm actually just going to recommend that people read the book so that they can understand that.
Let me just jump in on the biological age for a second so people hear this too. Because to your point, what I write about in the book is that we don't just have a single biological age. And for somebody to quote an age that, or get a test done and run it through an algorithm and say, oh, you're 10 years younger or 15 years younger or whatever, it's actually misinformation. It's actually dangerous. And the reason is because in the clinic here, we measure over 60 different biological ages. You have a brain age, a blood vessel age, a heart age, a telomeric age, a mitochondrial age, a senescent cell burden age, if you will. You have many, many, many ages of bone density age, et cetera. And you're really only as young as your oldest age. So when an influencer comes on and says, I'm 20 years younger, 30 years younger, 15 years younger, whatever, you have to really look at that with a grain of salt because there isn't one composite biological age that covers all the systems, right? They're giving you one test that they did, right? My youngest biological age is about 40 years younger than my chronological age. That's not my youngest, that's not my oldest biological age, right? So the point is you want to be skeptical when you hear that. It doesn't mean that biological age doesn't have value because it's important to know what is the age of my heart, my blood vessels, my bones, my brain. It's just important to understand that there isn't one number that will actually tell you that.
And as we're drawing towards our conclusion here, I wanted to ask you some personal kind of questions about your current stack of like supplements and habits to stay awesome. And like, what does your morning look like?
Yeah, well, you know, I left cardiology in 2012 and started on this journey of what's become Gladden Longevity. And one of the gifts that I gave myself when I left was I never wake up to an alarm clock. I allow my body to get the rest that it wants. So that's one piece. The second piece is that my morning routine is the first thing I do is I get up and I take thyroid. Part of my own journey was that I was significantly hypothyroid, even though all my lab tests looked normal. It wasn't until I did a biometric test, which was testing my reflexes and showed that they were slow, that I realized that I was low on thyroid in the tissues. And now we do a resting metabolic rate here. In fact, I'm going to do one when we hang up along with a VO2 max test here in just a minute. But point is, when you do a biometric test, you can actually see what is the level of thyroid activity at the cellular level. And that's super important. The other thing I didn't know was that I have a gene, a SNP, a DIO2 gene, where I don't convert inactive thyroid to active thyroid in my brain very efficiently. So just to be put on Synthroid or T4 was not going to be the solution for me. I needed to be on a combination of active T3 and T4. And when I did that, you know, the lights came back on. So the first thing I do is I take my thyroid. The second thing I do is I sit down and I journal. And it's a little gratitude journal. I write about three things that I'm grateful for today. And I really kind of go into, and it's not superficial. I really feel into it deeply. What's resonating with me today that I'm so grateful for, right? I'm grateful to be talking with you, Jonathan, on this podcast is one thing, right? It's a lovely conversation. So three things that I'm grateful for, and then three things that would make today great, right? And then I put down a couple of different affirmations about how I'm going to show up today or who I am. And that could be anything from something very physical to something very spiritual. And then I go about working out. So I work out every day. I put my sneakers on. And I think that it's really important for people to understand that working out, we all think it's about the muscles, right? But what I've come to understand is that really all of life comes down to one thing, right? Just one thing.
What's that? Do tell.
Yeah, do tell. It's optimizing our nervous system. How we think, how we feel, what we believe is true, what we believe is possible, right? Who we think we are. And also how we move through space, right? How fast our legs can turn over when we run. How strong a muscle is a function of how much nervous energy goes into contracting that muscle. So it's really about optimizing the nervous system. So when I work out, I do a lot of balance training. I do certain drills that keep my nervous system very alert. I do strength training. I do a lot of cardio because VO2 max trumps muscle mass all day long when it comes to longevity. Endurance athletes live a decade longer than strength athletes, right? So it's really important to work out. And because I want to be able to work out routinely, I never set myself up to exercise 5 days a week or 4 days a week or 6 days a week or 3 days a week. And the reason is once I do that, then I've got to decide in the morning, is today the day? And once you introduce a decision into the process, the failure rate goes to 100%. So I take the decision out. This is a hack that the audience can use also. Remove as many decisions from your day as possible. Make them automatics. So I automatically work out, right? And that, when you do that after, you know, not only like 4 or 5 weeks, you develop a new habit. When you do that for 3, 4, 5 months, it becomes an identity. I am an exerciser, right? This is who I am. I am physically active, right? And that really becomes important. So the next thing I do is I work out. Then I basically will sit down and look at my calendar, and I'll start taking some supplements, things I take before I work out, a little bit of creatine. I drink some hydrogen. We have a hydrogen product that we developed that is a tablet that's infused with energy, which is a quantum energy imprinting that happens.
Whoa.
Yeah, it's cool. And I also take another one from the same company called Rejuve, R-E-J-U-V. And when I take that, I feel very energized to work out. I also take things to improve nitric oxide production. Things to improve the glycocalyx. So there's a company that makes a product called Revasca that will regrow the glycocalyx, which is the holy grail of keeping your arteries healthy. Then nitric oxide comes into play. So we'll drink like green smoothies the night before or whatever, filling my body with dietary nitrate. And then the next morning I can use Neo 40 Pro to release that and make nitric oxide, which makes the workouts easier. I have some NAD boosting supplements that I take because I don't have cancer. There's so many things I do, but anyway, I do that. And then from there, after the workout, you know, I go about my day and I come into the office and chat with cool people like you and meet with clients and then develop, you know, new technologies and things we're working on. So, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's a pretty good way to start the morning.
Oh, one last thing. I meditate. I didn't mention that. Sorry.
Okay.
I do meditate. So I'm a big fan of a device called BrainTap, and I don't have any financial interest in this company. It's called BrainTap, and we use their NeuralCheck here in the office to actually test the autonomic nervous system balance of the clients and ourselves, for that matter. BrainTap is really cool because you can actually entrain your brain into a meditative state. Even if you don't know how to meditate, if you allow it to, it'll pull you into a meditative state. And it uses binaural beats, a little bit different frequency in each ear, and it, which the brain has to kind of focus on. And then it puts photobiomodulation through the eyes and through the ears. So now when you put it on and you adjust the intensity of the flashing lights and the sound, you can really just kind of go off into this meditative space. And then you can choose the waveform that you want to go into. Like, I woke up in the middle of the night at 1 o'clock and I wanted to go back to sleep. So I put it on Delta for 11 minutes, and Delta is the sleep waveform, and I fell right back to sleep. Theta is deep and profound meditation, right? And so I use Theta in the morning many times when I wake up, or in the afternoon when I get home. Alpha is more traditional meditation, and then Gamma is a flow state. So if I'm going to go mountain bike ride, I'll put it on and put myself into a Gamma state, and then jump on the bike and take off, right? So it's very, very cool. This is about, remember, all of life comes down to optimizing the nervous system. This is a big way in which we optimize the nervous system, is to be able to put ourselves into the state that we want to be, a flow state, a meditative state. And the idea with meditation is not, oh, I meditated for 10 minutes or 15 minutes, now I'm going to go about my day. It's actually to go through your entire day in a meditative state, right? So in essence, have been in a meditative state this entire conversation, right? Staying in a meditative state enables you to lower stress in your system, right? It enables you to become Keanu Reeves, where when they fire the bullet, you just lean back and it's like, oh, well, that's an interesting bullet going by, but you don't have to take the bullet as it comes in. It's the idea of the way I explain it for my clients is if you've ever seen a good mogul skier, right? When they go down a mogul run, their upper body is still. Their body is down the fall line. They're looking not at the mogul in front of them, but all the way down the hill, right? Future focused vision. And their lower body's doing all the work. And every mogul is not a problem. Every mogul is an opportunity. So when you go through life where there are no problems, there's only opportunity, there is no failure, there's only the ability to learn and get better, right? And your upper body is still, your mind is still while you're going through your day. See how you're going through day in a flow state, a meditative state. This is such a massive step forward towards a 300-year-old mind, and it lowers so much stress in the biology. It's one of the absolute keys to longevity, as I see it.
So the BrainTap device is like a major flow state hack.
It's a flow state hack. It's also a deep meditation hack. It's a sleep hack. You dial in the waveform you want, and it'll take you into that waveform. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, that's something I've been meaning to try. So I will include that in the list of different things that we've talked about, which people can find via the link below, wherever they are watching or listening to me. In conclusion, here, real good point. I'll quote something that jumped out at me in the beginning of your book. We are the luckiest generation of all time because we now understand how to accomplish what every other generation in every culture wanted to do, to maintain our youthfulness and live young for a lifetime. And yet, this is an important thing. There's a temptation to succumb to the doomerism of modernity. All of the awful news about the things going on in the world and politics and AI devouring everything, and for younger people, the challenges that they face trying to find love and meaning in this chaotic world. Yeah, there's a lot of doomerism coming at us, but truly, we are so fortunate to have been born in this very unique inflection point in history, at a time of both accelerating freedom and accelerating tyranny. There's not very many other points in history where those two things were happening simultaneously. And we are blessed to, by randomness, perhaps by God, by the universe, by source, whatever you want to believe in. We were blessed to be born at this important point where we can make a difference in trying to help humanity to pass through Fermi's great filter, which is kind of I'm kind of alluding back to what you were saying about something about civilizations never survive
200 years.
200. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering where does that come from? Because we are the only civilization that we know of for sure. Or are we getting into a UFO discussion here?
Yeah, we are getting into UFO discussion and alien.
Okay,
and,
I like it.
Yeah. So there's, I think there's tons of evidence about this. There always has been. And, you know, now all the governments, even the ones that denied it for years, like Japan, et cetera, are talking about UFOs, that, you know, the UABs, that unidentified aerial vehicles that are out there that nobody knows. There's been so many encounters with different things. And I'm not a conspiracy theorist. But I do think that we are not alone in the universe. And I also think that we chose to come here at this point in time. And humanity actually needs us because we are at this very critical inflection point on the planet with the convergence of all of these technologies. And certainly AI does have the ability to take us out. I don't think there's any doubt about that. You know, you look at all the people that have left OpenAI or other companies because they're worried about the safety of this. And it's not a trivial concern. Then you've got, you know, you've got politicians that are, you know, flying off the handle. You've got, nukes all over the place. I mean, it's a really interesting time to be at on this planet. And I think we're here for a reason. And I think if we can help the planet navigate towards the 3,000-year-old mind and maintain youthfulness, that we have a chance to actually, you know, get through the filter and step into something that could be really, really spectacular. It's really spectacular now, but I think we're here for a reason. That would be my comment.
Amen. So, call to action for listener. Big question to think about. Maybe, dear listener, you want to go stroll in a cemetery this weekend and think about this question, because it's just about to be springtime most places in the world. Cemeteries can be really beautiful places in the springtime. Go for a stroll in the cemetery without your smartphone and think about what your multi-century goals might be. Yeah, go spend 45 minutes doing that, and you'll come back with something real special. And then I'll link up to Dr. Jeffrey Gladden's book. They'll find that below. In addition to, I'm going to link to Gladden Longevity Shop, and people are really going to want to go there and take a look at the TA65 skin cream. Yeah, go take a look at this. This will blow your mind. And this would also be the most appropriate product that you'd want to lather on if you get invited to the vampire's villa. So I'll just leave people to explore that.
I'll just add a couple quick things if I might. And that is, if you're interested to connect with us, you can go to gladdenlongevity.com. We're there. And also we have a podcast as well, the Gladden Longevity Podcast. And we've got about, 320 episodes out there now. So lots of interesting conversations, kind of like the one we had here. But I interview a lot of different interesting guests. And I also did one for the Doctor's Talks, where I interviewed 30 different really interesting people also on a longevity summit that's over there as well. So if you're hungry for more information on more topics, there's a ton of stuff out there.
A few of you might be curious about that first question that I posed to Dr. Gladden with the Faustian deal with the vampires. And it was actually inspired by the premise of a novel that I enjoyed recently, Out of the Shadows, a vampire mystery thriller by Vox Day. And you might want to add it to your reading list along with Hourglass, my novel about biohacking, seduction, and philosophy. At the end of this podcast, I'll add a really catchy, dark synthwave song that I created inspired by this hypothetical moral dilemma. I'm Jonathan Roseland with Limitless, looking forward to a continued conversation with you.
A summons in the night to a villa where the marble reflects the pale moonlight. I thought I'd found the patrons to fund the telomere dream, but the board of directors is a much more ancient scheme. They aren't just youthful billionaires with skin of alabaster. They're the architects of history, every servant, every master. They whispered of a masquerade maintained since time began, and how my little science project might ruin every plan. Longevity is for the few, not the many, they say. As they sip from crystal flutes in a crimson display, that holds the global reins. Take the billions they suggest and bury all the proof. Keep the public in the dark, far beneath our vaulted roof. Price the peasants out of life, make the cost of breathing high. Only sell to those who deserve to never have to die. They want a monopoly on the clock and on the breath, while the common man remains a faithful light of death. They offer me a fang to the neck, a seat among the stars, to watch the centuries pass by behind these velvet bars. But if I choose the sunlight and the path of the sincere, they'll unleash a propaganda storm to feed the public fear. They won't break my bones of blood, they'll just erase my name, discrediting the science and a sophisticated game. Call me a charlatan, a peddler of a lie, while they sit in their yachts and watch the world go by. Longevity is for the few, not the many, they say. As they sip from crystal flutes in a crimson display, will you take would break the social spine, overpopulation, resource wars, and a cultural decline. Humanity is far too young for centuries of life. They need the fear of ending to mitigate the strife. They claim to be the shepherds of our evolutionary soul, guiding us with wisdom as the eons slowly roll. Wait a few more hundred years, let the species learn to grow before you let the secrets of the silver fountain flow. I'm staring at the champagne flute, the bubbles dark and thick. The Codex Immortalis Aspirantis is a heavy brick. Do I stay loyal to the many, to the truth and to the light, or make a strategic compromise to survive this endless night? Is the democratization of life a gift or just a curse? As I weigh the heavy burden of the vampire's private purse, the anti-empathy of power is a seductive, cold-blooded lord. deal. The fang to the neck. Their biting kiss of immortality. Or would you choose to be a martyr for a public that might just use their extra centuries to argue on the internet? The choice is yours. Edify yourself at limitlessmindset.com.